Welcome back to the Knowledge Force Hypothesis Podcast. You are listening to Episode 3, Life's Great Library. In our previous two episodes, we've been tracing a grand narrative, a story about a potential underlying principle of our universe. We've called it the Knowledge Force Hypothesis. The core idea is that the universe isn't just a chaotic collection of particles. It has an inherent tendency to organize itself in ways that create, store, and propagate adaptive, problem-solving information, what we call knowledge. We started with the basics, the simple physical knowledge encoded in the structure of atoms and molecules. Then we moved to the heavens, exploring how stars act as cosmic forges, creating complex chemical knowledge through nuclear fusion. And now we arrive at the most dramatic and powerful expression of this force we've encountered yet. We're moving from physics and chemistry to biology. In this episode, we're going to explore the idea that the entire 4 billion year story of life on Earth is not just a random walk, but a profound experiment by nature in creating and refining knowledge.
So, to put it simply for our listeners, the big question for this episode is, what if evolution itself is a learning process? What if DNA is life's first great library and every living thing, every plant, every animal, every microbe is a book of survival strategies written over eons?
That is exactly the question. And we'll see how that library, written in the language of genetics, eventually gave rise to an entirely new kind of knowledge processor, the brain, which completely changed the game.
So, genetics, DNA as a repository, tell us more about how.
Well, to really understand DNA as a knowledge repository, we have to start with the work of a truly revolutionary evolutionary biologist, Richard Dawkins. Back in 1976, he published a book that changed the field forever, The Selfish Gene. Dawkins proposed that to understand evolution, we need to stop looking at it from the perspective of the organism and start looking at it from the perspective of the gene. He argued that genes are fundamentally replicators. They are units of information whose only goal, metaphorically speaking, is to get copied and passed on to the next generation. Organisms, from an amoeba to a blue whale, to you and me, are what he famously called survival machines, or robot vehicles, intricately built by this genetic information for the sole purpose of helping it propagate. And our knowledge force hypothesis takes this profound idea and looks at it through a slightly different lens. If genes are information that builds a successful survival machine, then that information is knowledge. It's not conscious knowledge, of course. A gene doesn't know anything in the way we do. But it is adaptive, problem-solving information. It's knowledge about physics, chemistry, and ecology, encoded in the molecular structure of DNA.
Okay, let me see if I can clarify that for myself and for everyone listening. So, you're saying a polar bear's gene for thick fur isn't just a recipe for a protein. In the language of the knowledge force hypothesis, that gene is a piece of knowledge. It's a sentence in the polar bear's survival manual that says, "This is how you survive in the brutal cold of the Arctic." And that sentence wasn't written by a conscious author. It was written through trial and error over thousands of generations, because the ancient bears with slightly thicker fur were the ones who survived the cold, had cubs, and passed on that successful idea encoded in their genes.
Yes, indeed. And let me give some other examples to help grasping the idea. The gene for a bat's echolocation is knowledge of acoustics. The gene for a flower's bright colors is knowledge of how to attract the right insects. The organisms themselves don't need to understand the principles. Their DNA knows it for them, in the sense that it embodies a design that successfully harnesses those principles to keep the survival machine running. And that brings us to the crucial next question. How is this knowledge created? It feels like there's a designer, but there isn't one. To understand the mechanism, we can turn to two other brilliant thinkers from different fields. First, the physicist David Deutsch, known for his profound work on the nature of reality and progress, particularly in his book The Beginning of Infinity. Deutsch makes a powerful observation. Apart from human creativity and thought, Biological evolution is the only other process we know of in the entire universe that creates new explanatory knowledge.
So, evolution is a knowledge factory. It's one of only two such factories we know of.
Exactly. And the second thinker, the philosopher of science, Donald Campbell, gave us the blueprint for that factory. Campbell developed a field he called evolutionary epistemology, which is a fancy way of saying the theory of how knowledge evolves. He argued that there is a universal mechanism that underlies all knowledge creation, from an amoeba learning to find food to a scientist developing a new theory. He called this mechanism blind variation and selective retention.
Blind variation and selective retention?
Yes. Let's break that down because it's the engine of everything we're talking about today. Blind variation refers to random genetic mutations. A cosmic ray might strike a piece of DNA or a copying error might occur. These changes are blind because they have no foresight. They don't know if they'll be helpful, harmful, or neutral. They are just random shots in the dark. And selective retention is the process of natural selection. The environment, with its predators, its climate, its food sources, acts as a brutal editor. It selects which of those blind variations happen to work and retains them by allowing the organism carrying that variation to survive and reproduce. The countless failures are simply deleted from the gene pool. The successes are copied and spread.
I love that. It's like a writer trying to find the perfect sentence. They don't know what it is ahead of time, so they blindly type out 100 different versions. That's the blind variation. Then they read them all aloud and delete the 99 that sound clunky or don't make sense, keeping the one that just works. That's the selective retention. Over millions of years, nature isn't just writing a single sentence. It's using this exact process to write the entire epic poem of life, one successful word at a time. It's a learning algorithm.
It is the ultimate learning algorithm. And what's remarkable is how this synthesis of ideas from a biologist like Dawkins, a physicist like Deutsch, and a philosopher like Campbell gives us a complete picture. Dawkins tells us what the knowledge is, its survival information in genes. Deutsch tells us why it's important. It's one of the universe's two known knowledge creation engines. And Campbell tells us how it works, through the universal algorithm of blind variation and selective retention. Together, they form the bedrock of how the knowledge force expresses itself through biology. For billions of years, this genetic knowledge was accumulating, but it was doing so very slowly, on an evolutionary timescale. It was incredibly robust. DNA is a fantastically stable information storage medium, but the process of creating new knowledge required generations of life and death. The evolution of the nervous system, and eventually the complex brain, was a phase transition. It was like the universe inventing a completely new type of computer. It was a new substrate for knowledge, one that was fast, dynamic, and capable of learning within a single lifetime. And this is where we need to introduce a more precise term, a key idea for our podcast and for the Knowledge Force hypothesis. We often think of brains as vessels or containers for knowledge, like a hard drive you fill with files. But that's far too passive. It doesn't capture the dynamism of what's happening. The Knowledge Force hypothesis proposes a better term. Brains are catalyzers of knowledge.
A catalyst. I remember that from chemistry class. It's something that dramatically speeds up a chemical reaction without being used up in the process. So what does that mean for a brain?
It means the brain doesn't just hold knowledge, it dramatically accelerates the creation of new knowledge. It takes in streams of data from the senses. It combines that data with stored memories. It finds patterns. It runs simulations of the future. And it generates novel solutions and behaviors at a speed that DNA could never dream of. And here's the most incredible part. This catalytic process is so powerful that it even changes the structure of the catalyst itself. This idea that knowledge actively reshapes the brain brings us to the work of the brilliant French cognitive neuroscientist Stanislas Dehaene. Deheen's work provides the stunning biological evidence for this brain-as-catalysator idea, most famously through his neuronal recycling hypothesis. He starts by posing what he calls the reading paradox. Reading and writing are, in evolutionary terms, brand new inventions, only about 5,000 years old. That's the blink of an eye. Evolution couldn't possibly have had time to build a dedicated reading module in our brains, so how on earth do we all learn to do it, and why do we all use the same part of the brain to do it? Deheen's research, using advanced brain imaging, shows that when we learn to read, our brain doesn't grow a new part. Instead, it recycles or repurposes an existing part of our visual cortex. Specifically, it takes over a region that evolved over millions of years for recognizing objects and their constituent parts, things like edges, corners, T-junctions, and curves. He calls this the visual word form area. This pre-existing circuit, designed for recognizing things in the natural world, turns out to be perfectly suited for the new task of recognizing letters, which are, after all, just a collection of lines and curves. The cultural invention of reading finds a neuronal niche and colonizes it.
Wow. Okay, that is a huge idea. So it's not like installing new software on a fixed piece of computer hardware. It's more like the software itself is actively rewiring the computer's motherboard to create the perfect circuits to run it. The knowledge, the skill of reading, is an active force, not a passive file. It physically changes the brain. That's the catalysator idea in action.
It's the perfect illustration. Knowledge isn't just being stored. It's harnessing and optimizing its own substrate. And this catalytic process goes into overdrive when you connect these individual brains together into a network. This is the central insight of another giant in the field, the developmental psychologist Michael Tomasello. Tomasello has spent his career comparing the cognitive abilities of human children and our closest primate relatives, like chimpanzees. He argues that what makes human cognition truly unique is not just our raw individual intelligence, but our evolved capacity for what he calls shared intentionality.
That sounds interesting, Mark. Shared intentionality. Do tell us more about that. What is shared intentionality?
This is the uniquely human ability to form joint goals, to collaborate on a task while understanding the roles and intentions of others, to teach and learn from each other explicitly. Tomasello's research shows that early humans who could cooperate effectively on a hunt, in making complex tools, in raising children, had a massive survival advantage. This created an intense evolutionary pressure, not just for bigger brains, but for brains that were exquisitely tuned for managing shared knowledge and communication.
So our brains didn't just get bigger. They got better at networking. Being the smartest person in the room wasn't the ultimate advantage. The real evolutionary leap was being able to create a smarter room. You had to be smart together.
Precisely. And this creates a powerful feedback loop that is a perfect example of the knowledge force at work. Tomasello shows us the social need for shared knowledge that drove our evolution. And Deheen shows us the neuromechanism, neuronal recycling, that allows our brains to be flexible enough to adapt to the cultural tools, like language and writing, that make this sharing possible. The force of knowledge, operating through the medium of social connection, literally shaped our neural architecture to become better and better catalyzers. This reveals a fundamental shift in the speed and mechanism of the knowledge force. For billions of years, it operated on the slow generational timescale of DNA, using the costly method of life and death to filter information. With the brain, it began operating on the timescale of a single lifetime, using the much faster mechanism of neuroplasticity and error correction. But with culture, born from shared intentionality, the force accelerated again, creating a collective intelligence where knowledge could accumulate and be transmitted across a whole society without any single individual having to discover it all from scratch. The process just keeps getting faster and more efficient. Now, it's absolutely crucial that we address a common misconception. The knowledge force hypothesis does not propose a simple, smooth, inevitable march of progress towards some glorious endpoint. The history of life is messy. It's filled with starts, stops, dead ends, and catastrophic setbacks. Think of the great mass extinctions. The asteroid that slammed into the Earth 66 million years ago didn't just kill the dinosaurs. In our terms, it obliterated an immense repository of accumulated knowledge. All the fine-tuned genetic solutions for thriving in countless ecological niches of the Cretaceous period, the designs for T-Rex's bite for a Triceratops' defense, for the entire ecosystems they inhabited, were erased from Earth's living memory in a geological instant. We also see what's called regressive evolution. Consider creatures that adapt to life in total darkness, like in a deep cave. Over generations, they often lose their eyes. From a traditional progress viewpoint, this seems like a step backward. But in the language of the knowledge force hypothesis, this is knowledge being strategically pruned. The complex genetic information for building and maintaining eyes is energetically costly. In an environment where that information provides no benefit, it's a liability. So evolution discards it to optimize for a new, narrow strategy.
So knowledge isn't just gained, it can be lost on a massive scale. The great library of life can have entire sections burned to the ground. The river of knowledge can hit a dam, or even dry up completely in certain places.
Exactly. And this brings us face to face with one of the most important critiques of any idea of evolutionary direction, and a vital piece of the puzzle, from the celebrated paleontologist and writer Stephen Jay Gould. Gould was a powerful and eloquent opponent of what he saw as the lazy, arrogant idea of an evolutionary ladder of progress, with humans perched at the top. He famously argued that evolution is wildly contingent. He proposed a thought experiment. If you could replay the tape of life from the beginning, the chances of getting anything remotely like human beings again are virtually zero. He saw evolution not as a predictable path, but as an enormously branching bush. And he pointed out that for most of Earth's history, for 5/6 of it, in fact, life was nothing but single-celled organisms. The appearance of complexity, he argued, isn't evidence of an inherent drive or force. It's more of a statistical artifact. If you start at a wall of minimal simplicity, the only way to go is towards more complexity. It's a random walk, not a driven march.
This sounds like a major challenge to the knowledge force hypothesis. If there's no inherent direction, if it's all just a contingent, random walk, how can there be a force pushing towards knowledge? It seems like Gould's view and the knowledge force hypothesis are in direct opposition.
It's a brilliant and absolutely necessary challenge, and you're right to see the tension. But the knowledge force hypothesis is subtle enough to accommodate Gould's crucial insights. The hypothesis does not claim that evolution has a predetermined goal or that its path is a straight line. It completely agrees with Gould about the profound role of contingency and chance. The path is unpredictable. However, the knowledge force hypothesis makes a different kind of observation. It notes that while the path of evolution is random and unpredictable, the underlying process, Campbell's selective retention, has an emergent effect when viewed over vast cosmic timescales. It has a statistical tendency to accumulate and preserve solutions that work. The force isn't a teleological push from behind or a pull from some future goal. It is an emergent property of a simple repeated rule. Keep what works, discard what doesn't.
Okay, I think I'm getting it. Let me try the river analogy again. Gould is looking at the river from the riverbank. He's seeing every unpredictable twist and turn, every oxbow lake, every time the river gets diverted by a rockfall. From that perspective, the river's path is entirely contingent on the local geology. It's unpredictable. But the knowledge force hypothesis is taking a satellite view. It's looking at the underlying physics. It acknowledges all the local twists and turns, but it also sees the fundamental force of gravity that creates an overall, long-term tendency for the water to move downhill towards the sea. Gould is focused on the contingent riverbed, while the knowledge force hypothesis is focused on the emergent directionality caused by gravity.
That is the perfect analogy. It resolves the apparent conflict. The knowledge force hypothesis is not a theory of inevitable progress, it's a theory of emergent tendency. Gould's focus on contingency is correct and essential, but it doesn't negate the observation that, over the long run, the process of selection tends to build repositories of adaptive knowledge. After every mass extinction, life diversifies again, often exploring new and more complex solutions. The death of the dinosaurs, a contingent catastrophe, cleared the way for mammals, which eventually led to the evolution of a new kind of intelligence. The path is winding, but the overall movement is towards greater accumulation of knowledge. So as we pull all these threads together, we see this incredible story. Biological evolution, through its blind learning algorithm, spent billions of years crafting a substrate, DNA, and then a powerful catalysator, the brain. This set the stage for the next great leap in the expression of the knowledge force. And here, we turn to the philosopher Daniel Dennett, who, building directly on Richard Dawkins' work, gave us the concept of memes. Dennett argued that just as genes are biological replicators, ideas, tunes, technologies, fashions, any unit of culture are also replicators. He called them memes. They are like viruses of the mind that spread from brain to brain through imitation and communication. They compete for our attention, they evolve, and the successful ones propagate. A good idea, like the knowledge of how to make fire or plant crops, is a meme that replicates rapidly because it confers a huge survival advantage to its hosts, the people who hold that idea.
So the knowledge force finds a new, much faster vehicle. It's able to jump from the slow biological hardware of genes to the lightning-fast software of memes, which run on the neural hardware, the brain catalysators, that evolution spent billions of years building.
Yes, and what's truly profound is that this principle of information spontaneously creating complex patterns has even deeper roots in the universe, taking us back to the border of physics and biology. Here we have to mention the great mathematician and computer pioneer Alan Turing. In his later years, long after his famous work on computation and code breaking, Turing became fascinated by biology. He wrote a single seminal paper on the topic called The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis.
The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis.
In this paper, Turing showed with pure mathematics how two simple chemicals, an activator and an inhibitor, diffusing and reacting with each other in a uniform medium, could spontaneously generate the complex, ordered patterns we see all over nature, like a zebra's stripes or a leopard's spots. It was a foundational demonstration of how structured, complex information can emerge from a simple, uniform state, driven only by basic physical and chemical rules.
So Turing provides a kind of proof of concept right from the level of basic chemistry. He showed that the universe has this built-in tendency to create complex, information-rich patterns from very simple starting conditions and rules. It's the knowledge force operating at its most fundamental level, a precursor to everything that life would later achieve.
That's the perfect way to summarize it. Biological evolution, through the blind but powerful algorithm of variation and selection, spent billions of years crafting first a stable knowledge substrate, DNA, and then a revolutionary knowledge catalyzator, the brain. It solved the problem of accumulating and refining knowledge about the physical and biological world. With the arrival of humans, that catalyzator became networked through culture, language, and shared intentionality, unleashing the knowledge force in an entirely new and explosive medium, the world of memes. We've journeyed from the first replicating molecule to the first self-aware mind capable of looking back and asking these very questions. We've seen how knowledge is not just something we have, but a force that has actively shaped our bodies, our brains, and our societies.
It's an incredible story. We've gone from a molecular library to a neural supercomputer to a global network of minds.
And the story is far from over. On our next episode, we will explore this new cultural landscape. We'll look at how the knowledge force has continued to accelerate through human history, driven by inventions like writing, the printing press, science, and now digital technology, leading us right up to the modern age and the unprecedented challenges and promises of our future. Thank you again for listening. If this third episode sparked something in you, then hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. Share this bold idea with a curious friend, leave a review to join the journey, or to challenge it. Join me next week as we push the idea further into human culture and collective intelligence. Until then, let's rethink everything.